Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the grit in my oyster. It's Dave Vitti. Mate, these get better and better every week, don't they?
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind of you to say. How are you? You all right?
Yeah. I'm very good, thanks. How are you?
Good. I'm very good, thank you. And I'm excited today because we have somebody rather special joining us today. Mr. Plato?
We do indeed. We do indeed. Now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor quote your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. So, Dave, our special guest today, well, he's someone very special, actually. A gentleman with a touch of class. A gentleman who knows his way around the kitchen. And I'm not just talking spag bol or beans on toast. You know, our staple foods that we knock up. I'm talking proper nosh, proper cooking. He's not just any chef. He's something of a master. It is, of course, Mr. Marcus Waring. Welcome. Hi, Marcus. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me. Really looking forward to this conversation about cars.
Well, listen, before we get on to cars, I have to say, Marcus, genuinely, I'm chuffed to have you on because I'm a fan. I'm the sort of person that has MasterChef and MasterChef the Professionals and all the other incarnations on Series Link. And I watch it, and I genuinely, and I'm not just saying this, and I know you're the same, JP, you've got your hand up, is that
absolutely.
I make stuff and I look at the skills test and all these different things, and I do. So I'm chuffed to bits that you're on here. So first question for me is how did the MasterChef thing first come around? That's obviously what you're best known for in the, you know, in terms of being a household name, but how did you transfer from being a esteemed restaurateur to being on the telly in that form?
It was interesting because it was the professional chef person in what I do and I've been training and been doing all my life was the reason that it sort of came knocking on my door. And it really came about 8 years ago. I'm about to start filming my ninth series.
Wow.
And Michelle Roux was the judge that was there prior to me. Mm. But due to a sort of a hiccup in a contract, whatever it was, a commercial channel, they sort of asked Michelle to stop and leave, and actually we're going to look for someone new. And it literally was almost like they knocked on my door and said, would I consider replacing Michelle Roux on MasterChef? And quite interestingly, I first watched MasterChef when I was a young lad in Southport, when it was Lloyd Grossman in the red, the yellow and the green kitchen. That's where it started. And so that and a few other cooking shows at the time really inspired me. That's why I really, you know, I saw Top End Kitchens on the TV screen. I mean, MasterChef was different. Mm. But I've always said Michelle laid the ground for the first 7 years and I took over from there. And I've always liked what he's done. It's a pleasure and an honor for me to do it.
I mean, what a change as well, career-wise. Mm. I mean, you know, one of those things, as you say, sometimes things just happen, don't they, for whatever reason, outside of your control. And then something like that happens. And you must look back on it now and just, it's taken you off in a completely different direction, but for the good, surely.
Yeah, I mean, I saw in our industry magazine, I read that Michelle Roux had left the BBC and MasterChef. And I thought, and they're going to be looking for a new judge. And I remember reading the newsletter on my computer. And I thought, my goodness me, the world and his wife is going to apply for that job because it was a top-end opportunity. I deleted it. Thought,
that's no way.
Yeah, I just deleted it. I just deleted it like a piece of news and thought, it wasn't asking, it was just...
You thought it was shut down, it was a closed thing.
It was just a news piece. And I looked at it and I thought, imagine if I applied for that, I'd never get the job.
So how funny is that?
Read that piece of news, moved on, went back to my kitchen. And then sometime later, I got a phone call from the producer and it was, can I come and see you? And of course, through my career, I've always done little bits of MasterChef. You get asked to do Chef's Table or you get asked to do a demonstration in the amateurs or something. So they've always known quite a lot of chefs in the industry because they're in and out of our kitchens or filming, doing different things over the years. And that call was, can we come and see you? Didn't have a clue what it was coming to talk to me about. And I suppose what you say, the rest is history. And I've never looked back. It's a new chapter, but it's a new chapter that I was always wanting to do, but never really had the energy to go and look for it. Because I believe in television, they either want you, they'll come to you before you get accepted by them. They know who's out there in television and you know what they want. And I always thought, having spent quite a bit of time on and off television through Saturday Kitchen, working with Gordon, doing bits in MasterChef, and there's all sorts of TV shows that you can dip in and out of. I always thought, well, I haven't got the face for it. They know where I am. And actually...
I know that feeling.
And me.
I never went looking. I never went looking. And I think sometimes you do look back and think, wow, that was a bit of luck. And I grabbed it with both hands and never looked back. And I think one of the most important things for me as a member of an industry and part of an industry, and I've done my bit, the show is not about being on TV. The show is about finding the next talent and the new generation. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for the future chef, not the chef that's looking at history and what a very old-fashioned classical dish is all about. I want to be shown what the future of food looks like, and that's what MasterChef's all about.
Yeah, well, do you know what? That comes across because occasionally, whether it be a member of the public or one of the professionals that are on, you know, the two types of show you do, someone comes up with something different and you can see the enthusiasm, not just on your face, but everybody's face. That, wow, this is... And I forget which dish it was, but someone cooks something and you went, do you know what? Do you mind if I nick that? I'm amazed that there are still new ways of doing things after all these years of cooking. I suppose that's the best bit, isn't it? Finding someone that's the next new blood.
It is. It very much so. And I think it's because the Google is there now and social media, every chef can see everything. It's how, you know when a chef's going through the challenges, who's been on Google and tried to get some inspiration. A huge amount of success, in fact, a lot of success, has to come through looking for ideas, but the inner love and passion for food has to come from within. And that's something you either have or you haven't got.
And that's what
you're looking for, that natural talent who uses the facilities of what's around them at the time to enhance who they are. And the journey of MasterChef takes chefs from one part of their life into a whole new era and a new area that they've never been to before because they're... Mostly because their professional job doesn't apply them in that way. And MasterChef takes them on a fast-track journey into a world that they've never been in before. And it's absolutely brilliant. What comes out the other end?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you set the skills test for the professionals, you know, are there a few little dishes or sauces or whatever it may be that you know is going to nobble them? And if so, what are they?
My skills test, and actually I'm actually going through them at the moment for the next series.
Oh, go on, give us a little insight into what's going to trip them up next time.
No, it's not happening, guys. It's not happening. Because you'll lose your job and I'll lose mine.
We don't even have a real job, it's fine.
That's what concerns me, that's it, game over. It's you're looking for... Have they been to college? Have they learned basic skills? Do they know how to make what we call the classic, the sauces, the vinaigrettes, the cutting of meat, the cutting of fish, the frying, the sautéing? How do they move around the bench? Do they know what a bechamel is? Do they know what a hollandaise sauce is? Do they know what Italian, French, Swiss meringue is? Do they know the difference between what you could say is basic school education in the world of cookery? That is what the skills test is. We don't lay them out to trip them up. They just trip themselves up because you either have that knowledge or you don't. And if you haven't got the knowledge, can you look at the ingredients in front of you and sort of work out a way in which you've only got the ingredients that you need in front of you. So why only cook half of them?
I've seen that where there's one or two they've not put in, and I'm at home and I'm not a cook at all. I mean, I can rustle up a Sunday roast, but I think, why have you not put some of that in? Because clearly it's meant to be.
Exactly that. And it's the walking into a studio with very little in it apart from a very big studio with only but myself, Greg, Monica or whoever, lots of cameramen, lots of soundmen, home economists. And it's very daunting and it's very, very scary when it's brand new. Because when they literally open those doors, that's the first time they'll have walked on set.
Yeah. Ah, wow.
So it, as you see in TV, is exactly how it happens. And once they get over that, and it's a nice thing, the skills test lasts for 20 minutes. That's your first 20 minutes. That's the worst bit over and done with. And no one goes home after the first test. They get the chance to cook in the afternoon on the same day. So they get a double whammy at staying alive, basically.
No, I mean it's the time, isn't it? As you say, 20 yeah. minutes, and that 20 minutes must go in an absolute heartbeat yeah. when you're there, as you say, with the pressure yeah. of trying to do it in front of you and with the cameras on you and everything like that.
That's horrible.
And their mind just must go blank. I always like it when you see Monica or whoever, and they've done something crucially wrong. And it's just a bit like, oh my gosh, you know, what's going on here? You know, why have they not, you know, why have they not taken the skin off? Why have they not filleted yeah. it? Why have they not done whatever? And just this head in the hands moment. But aside from what you do professionally, Marcus, you know, I have to ask, because I suppose people always imagine that chefs spend their whole life cooking fine food, but indeed also eating fine food. I mean, you must like normal food as well. What's your Friday night tea if you've got your tracky bottoms on and you've got your tray on your lap, watching whatever, you know, on the telly? What's your go-to dish?
We in this, my house, my family, we're all cooks. All my kids cook. My wife's a brilliant cook. And we eat the same food as everyone else. We have the lasagnas, the spaghetti yep. bolognese, the curries. We had burgers last night. You know, we love a roast dinner. I love a fry up. I love a bacon sandwich. I love scrambled egg on toast. There's nothing in my house that no one else eats. The difference between me and everyone else, it just tastes better in my house than everyone else.
Right, we're coming around for Sunday lunch.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone always said, if you ever want to get locked in, if you ever go into lockdown again, go and get locked down in a chef's house. You'll eat well.
Do you know what? It's funny actually, because if you remember, Jason, we had we've had James Martin on, we had Tom Kerridge on during lockdown,
yeah.
and I think that was it. I think we were both trying to wangle an invite to Tom Kerridge's house, which is just the road from where we live, because we thought if we're going to get locked down anywhere, let's get locked down in his barn, and he'll be like feed us like kings for the next few months.
Job done.
But anyway, yeah, exactly. Job done. Just before we get onto cars, when do we see you back on the telly? Then when does MasterChef return?
So MasterChef starts, we start filming next month, and that will be coming on at the end of the year. But before then, I've also got 20 half-hour shows of Tales from the Kitchen Garden, which I filmed last summer,
nice.
Which is due to air during just towards the end of summer. So that comes first, which I've already filmed,
yeah. yep.
And then MasterChef after that. So there's quite a lot of me on television.
Quite a lot of Marcus time coming up.
That's all right. Doesn't make you a bad person.
Good. Like
it's great. Cars then. So car memories, earliest memories, you know, you know, was cars a passion of you and your dad or your family? Where did it all start?
No, definitely not at home. It was one car. That was it. But cars for me, the motor vehicles or all of that sort of stuff had to be my dad's warehouse. And at that warehouse, there was the best motor vehicle ever. And it was a forklift truck.
Okay. Yeah.
Forklift truck from the age of 11. I was allowed to drive on private land all the way up till I took my driving test at 16. And I also drove the wagons as well. So my attraction was that what was effectively a big Tonka toy, but it was a real piece of machinery and a very dangerous piece of machinery that I just kept going on and on about to the workmen. And they always used to let me have a go. My dad would too. So the passion came from the working man's trucks and wagons, massive big trucks that I used to go around in with my dad and the workmen. But I also got the opportunity that whenever we went onto private land, so whenever I went with a workman to go and pick up carrots or spuds or onions, you get to the gate of a farm. Between that gate of the gate of the farm, you're on private land to where the warehouse is or wherever. I would make that driver stop that wagon. I would then get into the driving seat and then drive that, because they just looked. We're just all fun people to get around. I didn't force them. They just whatever. And off I went.
We must just point out, actually, sorry, because you sort of alluded to it then, because your dad's business was in food as well, wasn't it? Didn't he sort of supply, was it sort of vegetables and food for restaurants, etc.? So that was your
mostly
sort of
my dad's fruit and potato business, or the family business, was a fruit potato merchant where we served mostly the school meal services of the Northwest region, about 800-900 schools through Liverpool, Sefton, Crosby, up all in the north, northwest, southport, Preston, Wigan area. And then restaurants and corner shops, those old things. You know, those little things on the corners?
Arkwright. Arkwright stores.
That's it.
They're now vape shops, aren't they?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, proper Arkwright saw. My dad always used to laugh at Arkwright because that till, that'd snap your hand off. That would put your hand in there. You try and take any pounds out of that, and you're going to get your hands bitten off.
Yeah, proper Northerner's till.
Yeah, no messing. So, what was the first car then? I mean, because that's always a milestone. What was the first one for you?
I went to work at a place called Gravetown Manor, and I didn't own a car. My first vehicle was a Honda Vision when I was at Southport Catering College, a little moped, 50cc, got me around town. Yeah. Then when I got a job, I'd been to London. So I left Southport when I was 17, went to London for 3 years, came back, and I started to go and work in a country house hotel, Gravetown in Kent, in Sussex. And I needed a vehicle, and my mum and dad lent me their car. So the first car that I went off and drove was a Honda Ballard.
It wasn't, I tell you what, wasn't that one of those, it was one of the Triumph and Honda co-productions. Yes. Do you remember? And they used to kind of build them on the same frame, but they would labeled as Hondas or Triumphs depending on, I remember that.
And so I had to give that back. Then I went off traveling to America, and I worked in upstate New York, and the head chef I worked in the Adirondack Mountains in Northern America in the New York State.
Yeah.
And he had a Volkswagen Corrado V8.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Oh, what a car. Mm. I came back and got my first head chef's job at a restaurant called L'Orangère with my business partner back there, Gordon. And that was the first car. Then when I was going out to buy my first car, it was a Volkswagen Corrado V8. Oh, I couldn't afford the Storm version.
Great car. How cool is that?
Yeah, great car.
Yeah, good-looking car, actually. Sexy-looking car.
It was on Top Gear many years later as a collector's item, and as a vintage car. And it was like, if you own one of these, don't sell it because it's going to be worth a lot of money down the line. But I remember watching Top Gear and thinking, I wish I kept hold of it.
Do you know what? You're probably right, because there can't be many of those around. So, no. Certainly not the V8 ones.
No, cracking car. No. Loved it. That was my first purchase. But that was my first head chef's job. So my dad always said, never live above your means. If you can afford something and you can afford to buy it. My first head chef's job, I was 25. So I was 25 when I bought my first car. And that was the first one.
Not a bad first car, right?
Not a bad first car. And good working class principles from your dad there. My old man was like that as well, you know, sort of live to your means, son, and stuff like that. None of this credit cards and any of that, you know. It's like,
that's right.
Buy what you can afford. You can buy what you can afford. Yeah. So where does it go then? What's the history after the Corrado?
It's interesting. Then I became very heads down. I owned that for good 3 or 4 or 5 years. And then, believe it or not, I went straight to a Carrera 4S Porsche with a really big back end, manual. Oh, what a car that was. And it was all about working at 1,000 miles an hour. I got a lot of support from Gordon. And we were together, Gordon Ramsay. And he said, I think it's about time you get yourself an effing proper car. We literally came from the airport. We'd been away somewhere, and he pulled in. We pulled into the Porsche garage from Heathrow. I think it's the old Chiswick Road. I can't remember.
Yeah, I know. It's on the left-hand side, isn't it? When you drop down off the elevated. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We pulled in there, literally had a chat, and I ordered a car pretty much straight away. It was about business partners working together, but we're working very hard. And I absolutely cherished that car. I loved it. It was, but when you're back then, I used to drive. I was very lucky that wherever I worked, I had a parking space in central London, because it was either a restaurant that we had parking spaces nearby, or it was in a hotel where we had a car park. So I was very, very fortunate that I had that opportunity. I always looked at it. People say, oh, you know, you're driving into London. I was driving to work at 6:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. I was coming home at midnight. So I wasn't really getting in anyone's way. Yeah. And I absolutely adored it. But as the years went by, when you're pumping the pedal and you're doing the manual, it takes its toll in London. My gosh.
Yeah.
And then I went from that, I don't know, I think that sort of, I sold that on to get a more of a family car, and it was the Land Rover Discovery. But then I had this great relationship back then with Jaguar. And then from Jaguar, it went into Mercedes AMGs. So my first car, sports car after that, was the Jaguar. And it was when Jaguar was an Arthur Daly car from Minder. Yeah. And Jaguar had reinvented, I think it was the XKR, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I got the opportunity as a face of hospitality on telly. And I had this fantastic relationship, and we leased very, very, very good value from them. And I drove one of those for quite a few years. And that was when you saw them on posters in London, and they were putting celebrity chefs and people in TV into these cars, and they just wanted them on the road. I really enjoyed that car, actually. But, I mean, out of all of them, I've got to say the Mercedes AMG GTS, wow.
Yeah, that's
for me was a cracker. I had three of those, same type of agreement, just one after the other. Every year that we just changed them. Beautiful car.
I was lucky enough a few years ago to get invited to the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa, courtesy of AMG Petronas, a team. And they took us across. There was myself and a load of motoring journos. And we sort of woke up in the morning in this hotel in Kent, and there was £2 million worth of AMGs all there. And they just gave you a king. Right, there you go. We're going, boop, boop. Okay, we're in that one. And off we went. Nice. And we drove it to Belgium, and then we drove another one back, and everybody's swapping cars. Absolutely unbelievable. And this is when they were all still, about 10 years ago. So they're all still the 6.3, the normally aspirated ones.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the big grunty ones before they reduce them. But, I mean, what cars they were. It's absolutely
superb. Did you, Dave, did at any point on your trip to Belgium, did you turn left to find an Autobahn just to give it a quick blat?
No, we were too far away from the Autobahn. I mean, you know, listen, we certainly drove to the maximum speed limit within whichever territory we were in at the time. I think it's fair to say that.
Yeah, plus or minus 50%.
Who can say? Anyway, please ask Marcus another question.
So, come on, out of all these great cars, there must be a chunky one, a worst car you've owned. Yeah, a nightmare.
Oh, wow. Ooh.
Not because you didn't start until you were in your 20s. So.
No, I never had, because I left home at 17, 18. You know, my first 3 years in London was just the tube was it. So I never had that young experience of having that fun, crappy car that was handed down by your sister.
That Dolomite that you got from your Uncle Albert or something like
right.
that.
That's right. You never had that. Yeah. No, I sort of missed it. And I think out of all of them, there was never a bad car, because I enjoy them. I always looked at cars. People ask me about, you know, the engine, what's under the bonnet and all of that. There's a few things that I look for me. It's the feel of something when you get into it, the luxury of the seats around you, the colour of the car, the wheels. I know it's going to have it. I know it's got an engine. I know it's going to move. And I know it's got certain key things that you look for, you know, that 0-60 and all of that. Mm. But at the end of the day, a car for me is more than just the massive engine and how fast it can go. I actually love the key things inside that has been designed so well by somebody. I don't think I've ever chosen anything bad. I mean, at the moment, my go-to car, and I'd say this is where I have a bit of an issue out of all of them, is the car I have now.
Right.
What do you think I've got now?
Oh, please don't say you've gone electric. He's gone electric.
Anyway, listen, Marcus, thank you so much for joining us.
Get him off. He's a traitor.
But
have you got a Taycan?
Yeah.
See, I'm a big poor Porsche fan. I had loads of them, been lucky enough to own loads over my life. And I'm not a big electric car fan, but you know what? I do actually like that car.
I've steered away. I am a petrol head through and through. I love petrol cars.
Yeah.
I was told by a friend who just bought one, the thing with electric car is if you own your own business, you can buy your electric car through your company.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which means you've saved 50% already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, Marcus, go and have a look at it. I did like the look of them. I always loved looking at new cars on roads. I remember when the Bentley Continental first came out and thought, what a weird looking car that is. And then as time goes on, it just gets more sexy and more sexy and more delicious. Mm. And you think, wow, that looks good. A lot of cars, new cars come out and you think, I'm not so sure about you. And then it's all about design. If we could all design a car, it's very hard to design a car of the future, because that's what's so special about design, like food. Who knows what the food of the future is going to be? Mm. When the Porsche came out, I fell in love with the Taycan visually from the outside. And yeah. I never took notice of it apart from, wow, that looks quite cool. When I was told to go and have a look at one, because you can do it through your own company, I went and had a test drive. And of course, I went with my wife. They don't come in the car with you because it was just after COVID. So they drove in mm-hmm. front of you in their car.
Yeah.
There was a nice bit of distance came between me and them showing me which way to go. And then you put your foot down.
Yeah.
Whoa. Do you know who told me that when you go electric, you'll always own one? James Martin, biggest petrol
head. Is that right?
He's got the Audi, and it was on his drive when I went filming at his house. And he said, the minute you drive a top-end electric car, I guarantee you'll love it and you'll keep it. You'll always have your petrol cars up the drive.
Yeah.
And he said, and you know what? You can't deny that when you're on a motorway and you're in a car like that and you're traveling at 40, 50 miles an hour and you need to accelerate past someone, you go A, B, C, you get around that car. You don't do C. It goes A, B, C. It goes to D. It's like, it misses. Yeah. It's like, shit, yeah. I've got from A to D much quicker than I was expecting. Like,
yeah.
And that's the
weird thing. I mean, they're supremely quick, aren't they?
Unbelievable. Mm. Unbelievable. And they're different inside. I have to say, though, I'm struggling with the battery. Someone in some office somewhere knows where I'm going. Someone knows what's wrong with my car.
Yeah.
Something broke on it recently and I didn't see it for 6 weeks. Oh, to get the car fixed, you have to, this other company says your car's been stolen. No, it's not. They can't access the car until you give us access to it. And there's this 3-4-way conversation going that the workman in the workshop can't fix or touch your car and do what he needs to do until you give him permission. Well, I said, well, I've given you permission, but the time's run out. He hasn't touched the car. So once that time's run out, we have to give him new position. I'll tell you something now. I actually couldn't quite believe how long it took me to get an engineer to fix that car because
is that right?
Computer says no. Or the app says no. Do you know what I did? Called the guy that sold it to me and said, no one call me about this car until it's fixed and it's on my drive. And if you can't fix it and put it back on my drive without me going through this process, give me my money back and I'll go get something else.
Yeah.
That's how annoying that process was. That's the problem with electric cars. And if you actually look around the country, you go to a petrol station on the motorway now, there's no charging points. There's nothing.
No, I know. Yeah.
So I can't plan beyond the 100 and 200 miles or whatever it is that you can do on it. I find it quite nervous when I'm going out and about.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I can't. I mean, I like that car, but I simply can't make the change to go electric just because of the way my driving is. You know, I need at least 300 miles guaranteed, no stress. Not that I'm going to do those 300 miles every time I get in the car, but I might do. And, you know, I've driven up the motorway, as we all done, and looked over, we called in for fuel and looked over, and all the charging points have got a queue on them.
So I see that Porsche as my secondary car. So it's the family Land Rover Discovery that is my main car right now, because I bought that Porsche thinking I'd use it for everything. And actually, I actually find it quite restrictive. I'm sorry, but I do not want to go to a petrol station and sit there for 45 minutes or an hour to drive my car. I'm not doing it.
No, this is the problem. Yeah. I was just going to say, though, is there any kind of, and Jason, you might know more about this from, you know, Fifth Gear Recharge and whatnot like that. Is there any capacity for someone like Marcus who's got that car or something similar, who's bought it now, and on the basis that, you know, you might want to keep that car, Marcus, for 5 years, for 10 years, whatever it is, as we always did with cars previously. Is there any capacity to then upgrade battery as and when advances come along? So in other words, if in 2 or 3 years' time, there was a battery that could then give you 300 miles or 400 miles. Can you upgrade that or not? Or is it just...
Well, that's really interesting, actually. We did an item last year of a company called NIO, N-I-O.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Chinese car company. Anyway, they have gone down the route of having battery swap stations throughout. There's quite a lot in China, Japan, and now they're rolling around in Europe. Unfortunately, they're not coming to the UK because we've left the European Union and we're on tier four, which is another 2 or 3 years. But anyway, we did this test where you drive the car and you go, right, oh, I need to charge, or more to the point, I'll swap the battery. Mm-hmm. So you go into your sat nav and it says, right, go there.
Yeah.
And as you approach the garage, there's a white box on the floor. You drive on the white box and it takes control. Car reverses you into a little, almost like a garage.
Woof, yeah.
Up on ramps. 4 minutes later, new battery in the car. Out you go.
Really?
And you've then got the ability to select which power battery you want. So you don't ever own the battery. You own the car, but you lease the battery. So every time you need a charge, it's 4 minutes, in and out, battery gone. That's the future of electric cars, I think. But I'm hopeful that e-fuels will come along before that and we won't ever have to use the bloody things.
Wow.
I.e. electric cars. Because they're too expensive and that most people can't have one because most people don't have a driveway.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very good point. I think the driveway, the just to get in the charger fixed to your house, looking at what type of electricity you've got, what X, Y, Z's. I mean, if it wasn't for my wife, I wouldn't be able to deal with it, getting all that set up. I can't see this happening.
Marcus, talk to me about bikes as well, because I know that they've been a passion of yours. Do you own any bikes at the moment?
Yeah. I started off with, as I said, with the little Honda Vision in Southport. Mm. And my father-in-law was massive into bikes. He was a great bike rider. Then he taught people how to ride them. You know, he had the big motorbikes, BMWs and so on. And they were always a passion of his. And then I've always wanted to take a bike test, but I never did it because I was in London. I always had cars. And I've had my children and they're still with me. And you always think, I've never really had the time to take the test. So when I joined MasterChef, to get from the studio, from home to studio and back again, because that particular show is such a massive production, they can't afford for the judges, the talent they call it, to be late. You've got to be on set because the production is massive financially every hour that goes wrong. Mm. So they hired what they called, there's only one company, they're called Limo Bikes, and they're a motorbike taxi service. Basically, no matter how much traffic's out there,
they're brilliant.
That rider, if that journey is an hour on a bike, they will get you there in an hour, no matter how busy those roads are. And they're ex-riders, they're ex-racers, they're ex-whatever. And there's probably about 8, 9, or 10 of them. They are an existing company that will never happen again. A taxi has to have 4 wheels on it. So they are one of one. And they get talent. Right? Yeah. So if anyone, generally the people that use them are people, city men, maybe business people, but mostly people in television, people in radio, getting from one show to another.
Yeah. Yeah,
or someone who wants to get to Wembley Stadium or Twickenham without hitting the traffic. Yeah. So they're very user-friendly. They got the bug for me to take my bike test.
Oh, really? Is that right?
We just talk bikes. And when you're on the back of a bike with someone who knows how to ride it for 30-odd years and you say, do me a favour, just let's accelerate a little bit. It's like, whoa, pretty cool.
What sort of bikes are they, Marcus?
They're big BMWs, massive 1,200cc's. Two-seaters with the big ones, and they're not.
Yeah.
They're very well ridden, and they are. You feel very, very safe. And you've got the seat to lean on. You've got you're well covered with everything. And so I got the bug, and I took my test. And I was surprised at how interesting but difficult the test was. I'll tell you what, though, since I took a motorbike test 5 years ago, I've become a better driver because it's made me a lot more aware of the road.
Yeah,
and there's nothing more. You don't feel you feel so vulnerable when you're on a motorbike. I've got a Yamaha off-roader for where I have my farm, a 250cc, and then I've got the BMW 800cc Trophy touring bike, which I absolutely adore. And I'm really struggling to even want to change it because I just love it. It's a sit-up bike. It's got great power. I've been riding now, I think 4 or 5 years now. And I think after the first 3 years, I think I've now know how to ride it. I took a risk going from nothing to an 800cc.
That's affirmative.
Yes. But I also used to have in the back of my mind that I've got a family and that I've learned so much from riding on the back of those bikes with those guys that they stood me in good stead. And I still use them from time to time. But there's nothing nicer than having a fantastic motorbike, which I've got upstairs in my garage. And every time I go in the garage, you know, I just look at it and it's always spotless. It's always clean. It's always undercover in the garage. I treat it like a bloody another child. You know, I love it.
It's so true what you say, though. I mean, I've been lucky enough to do those taxi bikes as well. There's a fella called Kerry that runs that company, I think.
That's it.
On there. And as I say, I've spent many a time on the back with him, and you have the headphones on, and they teach you so much. And as you say, your understanding of roadcraft, I think, is the expression. Yeah. Your understanding is so much better afterwards, because it's so much more, it's so much heightened when you're on a bike. And you know, as a driver, I mean, there's the classic mistake, you know, which is the bike killer, which is the right turn and not look, you know, when you've got bikes coming down the outside. But just that understanding of other vehicles on there does, as you rightly say, make you a much, much better driver. And yeah, I've sort of learned a lot doing that same thing.
Because you're actually looking for that blind spot more so.
Yeah.
Because you don't just use your mirror. I don't know about you, but I always now look over my shoulder as well.
Yeah.
Like a motorbike rider does. And I think, you know, there's an element that it does make you very much aware of where you are. It gives me an awareness in the car more so. But, you know, they often laugh at me because I'm a fair weather rider. I don't need a motorbike unless I'm doing television or I just want to go out and, you know, just get some fresh air. Generally, I'm a car person. But when I start filming MasterChef, which is going to be next month, for the rest of summer, I'll be on and off that bike and in and out of town and going through town. And I absolutely love it. There's no better place to ride through the city, London, the central parts of London, through the West End, and the city of London, all the way out, because we film in Bow, so it's up near where West Ham Stadium is. So I live in Wimbledon, and it's an hour ride from door to door. So the journey through central London in the summer months is fantastic.
Yeah, I bet.
Hey, two car fantasy garage. What would it be? You can have anything you want.
I've had a lot of cars. I've been lucky enough to drive Bentleys, Rolls Royces. Every now and again, I'll get someone in a journalistic magazine will say, drive that Ferrari. Love all of them. But I think I had this conversation. I bumped into Chris Harris at a cricket event a year ago. And I said to him, I said, why do I feel the need that I have to have a Bentley Continental? And he said, it's because you're a middle-aged bleep, 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 bleep.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. You're just basically a middle-aged dick who just wants that car. And that was the first time I met him.
I think he's right, though, isn't he? You get to that age, you go, I fancy one of them. Oof.
I just love the luxury inside it. I think it'd be a top-end Bentley Continental, and I think the new Land Rover Discovery, I just love the look of them at the moment. The Defenders.
Yeah.
I just like the look of them. I think they've reinvented a classic there. And I'm going to go with those two.
Wow. Very good. Very good.
Hey, I've got a funny Bentley Continental story.
Go on.
Go on then.
A GT. I had a press car of them when they first came out. Bright red. And we had the famous Reg TU, whatever it is, four nut numbers. And I'm driving around Oxford. It's a lovely summer's day. And I pull up in a little place called Jericho, which is like the trendy bit of Oxford, just to pull up to get out to go and get something from a shop. And just as I'm about to get out, this lady, middle-aged lady on a push bike, pulls alongside and just looks at me and goes, "Oh, behave." And I'll never forget that. What it was telling people on who were walking on the road, things about me I knew nothing about. Amazing. But what great cars.
Yeah. There's so many fantastic design cars out there. I don't know enough about everything. And there's, you know, all the classics as well that are just incredible. But I think in my day-to-day living right now, I wish I'd had the time and spent more time looking at alternatives and looking at cars and being more adventurous with it. But I've always been work focused, and I find that there's a lot of time I want to enjoy. And I think having the electric Porsche has given me a real fond love to relook and rethink about the petrol car, you know, and to maybe one day go out and rather than go full electric, actually go back to enjoying the cars that I really enjoy. And I think I think that the Bentley for me and the Defender, because I think I just like what they've done. And I just think they're new, they're designed really well. But I'd love to be able to go down the classic road and see what's venturing out there. But I sort of need help in that area of what to buy. But it's an expensive hobby. Cars are not cheap.
Isn't it just? But you know what? That leads us quite nicely on to a question that we ask all of our guests, Marcus. And this is something of a finale for you. We always say that music and cars go well together. So what we need is your fantasy drive, please. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you driving?
And also, I want to add another bit on the end of that, because it's you, Marcus. And after we've met you after the drive, where are we going to go for tea or a bit of supper?
Okay. So I'm going to go from where I live here in Wimbledon.
Yep.
We're going to be driving all the way through France, stopping at top-end chateaus with 2 to 3 star Michelin restaurants with a very, very fine wine list in every one. We will stop along that journey and enjoy 2, 3, 4 outstanding chateaus and eating at the best houses. We will make our way down to the south of France, down to the coast of the south of France, probably to Monaco area, around that area, the Côte d'Azur. And we would probably end up eating at Louis Kahn's, Alain Ducasse's, the most grandest, beautiful, classic-style fine dining in the cafe down there in Monaco. And I think that's going from, you know, the heart of London, traveling through France, because that's where I've been trained and worked and done a lot, and my food is very much based around there. I really appreciate what they've done and the way they've brought hospitality. They've brought food, you know, a lot of chefs in this country have been trained in the French way, and I think they've got a lot to answer to. I think that it's a brilliant place. And I think just sitting on the coast down there, we'd eat dinner in Louis Kahn's. I'd probably go with the Continental, just because I think it's a great tourer. I think it would be comfortable. And I'd be juggling between, I'm not a big music person, and people laugh at me because I've spent 30 odd years in kitchens, which 25 of those you could class as being in solitary confinement of prison. where I've never really had a love for music because I never really listened to it. We never had a radio in the house at home. I remember my brother, his first LP was Soft Cell, Tainted Love, by Mark Coleman. Played that forever.
That put you off.
I've never bought an LP. I've never bought a cassette. I've only ever sponged off other people. And I'd probably be listening to TalkSport, Radio 2, LBC or some podcasts probably. But I've been listening to LBC for years, and it gets me upset now. I go to Talk Sport now and listen to Ali McCoist. Makes me laugh.
Do you know what? I'm exactly the same. I started to listen to LBC quite a few years ago, the James O'Brien show in the morning, and I just can't listen to it now. So I find myself getting furious.
Yeah, I agree.
Furious with you know, general members of the public. So I don't listen to it anymore.
And it sort of makes you angry. You know, I've got lots of love. I love food, eating out. I love wine. I'm a massive boxing fan because that's the sport I did as a young lad. So I watch a lot of boxing. I love watching all the football on television, the Premier League, the Champions League, the World Cup. So I love all of those sort of things. So going on to Talk Sport, I'm really starting to just enjoy, you know, Simon Jordan, what an interesting character he is, on their show. And I just like listening to things. So music, I mean, it's really bad, isn't it?
It's not bad.
I tell you what, Dave, that's worked out rather well, because I'll get on the phone to Bentley. We'll organise some press cars. And then Marcus is going to take some great places for supper. Not just one day.
I know.
With like 3 or 4 different gaffes on the way.
Get it on.
Exactly. You know, sometimes we ask this hoping that we might kind of swing a little invite for the after show at the end. We've got a whole holiday mapped out here, Jason. This is fantastic. It's all good. And plus also, we can suggest some good motoring podcasts for him to listen to on the way down there.
Sounds good.
We know a couple of those, don't we?
Double bubble, all good. And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Well, that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thank you. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the fantastic Mr. Marcus Waring. Thanks, mate.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Here, here. Great to have you on. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, guys and girls, and we'll see you next time. Ta-da!